from the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced in Nelson, British Columbia at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman. On today's episode, we revisit with the topic of permaculture, a concept in philosophy that has grown significantly in popularity since we first aired a show on the topic back in 2006. Back in September 2008, Deconstructing Dinner's Andrea Langlois visited the Blue Raven Permaculture Farm on Salt Spring Island, British Columbia. We'll listen in on Andrea's visit and then travel to San Francisco, California, and then off to Devon, England, and take a glimpse at two more of the many examples of how permaculture is being adopted worldwide as a new way of cultivating food, shelter, and energy, and doing so while maintaining a harmonious relationship with their surroundings. Instead of working against nature, as agriculture and other systems so often do, permaculture seeks to work within it.
Permaculture is consciously designed landscapes which mimic the patterns and relationships found in nature, while yielding an abundance of food, fiber, and energy for the provision of local needs. Permaculture is permanent, sustainable culture.
Permaculture is the evolution of agriculture.
Permaculture is holistic living.
Permaculture is a way of creating sustainable human settlements over time that creates a harmonious relationship with all of the systems within that, including animals, people, and that anything you put into it further benefits the system, and the earth is never left in deficit, but rather is left in a much richer state than it was to begin with.
Permaculture is us humans learning from nature and how to live within nature sustainably.
Permaculture is abundant fertility.
Permaculture is really the whole relationship of the life cycle and how we want to give back to the earth as much as we take or even give back more.
Permaculture is working with ecological systems.
Permaculture is looking at how your actions affect the world around you and becoming conscious of that.
Permaculture is empowering.
Those are the voices of students enrolled in a three-week permaculture design course offered at Blue Raven Farm on Salt Spring Island, British Columbia. Hosted by instructors Brandon and Patty Bauer, Deconstructing Dinner's Andrea Langlois visited the farm in September 2008.
My name is Patty Bauer, and I am here on the farm with my husband and son, the Blue Raven Permaculture Farm on Salt Spring Island. And I discovered permaculture by absolute chance. Someone had asked me to come to Mexico to implement a permaculture design in a small community there. I had absolutely no experience other than doing environmental work.
My name's Brandon Bauer, and I live on the Blue Raven Farm on Salt Spring Island. And I've been studying permaculture since 1995. And I dropped out of university because there was nothing like that in the institutions at that time to help people learn to live a life that wasn't participating in the chaos. I had a class in university called Developing Sustainable Communities, and we sat around and we talked a lot, and there was no hands-on, and there was no skills training, and there wasn't even a study of native ecology. And so I realized very quickly that having a community is not sustainable unless there's food. And so I started to seek out perennial food systems and skill practices that would aid in unified system design and looking at agriculture and life and community and people living together and a whole new perspective.
We've been led to the trees, and it sounds like you might have a special role to play with the trees on this farm.
Well, when you think about perennial agriculture, there's a lot of money and energy consumed in creating annual vegetables, especially corn and soy and meat products. And so in order to look at a more perennial system, the obvious answer became trees. The amount of biological diversity from different climates that are similar all over the world, just the sheer amount of food that one can consume on a yearly basis just by turning agriculture into perennial forage systems. So we have apples, plums, pears, peaches, apricots, almonds, edible dogwoods, three different species of edible dogwoods, monkey puzzle, chestnut, edible oak, English walnut, black walnut, pine nuts, olives, lemons, pomegranates, mulberries, there's more figs, you know. So we're really working on maximizing the amount of different types of foods that we eat. And those are just tree crops. That's not all the other perennials that we can incorporate into these systems and medicinals. So originally I also started by looking into nutrition and Chinese medicine and Western or European herbalism. And I realized that many of the people that practice those practices don't know how the plant grows or how to harvest it or how to prepare it to actually consume it as medicine. And so then that opened up a whole nother box of possibility, of opportunity in medicine. So ginkgos and linden trees, elm, beech, apple, gary oak, the native species too. So really incorporating as much diversity of native and non-native species into these systems as we possibly can. It allows us to forage and eat from our land from really May all the way through to November. And then there's dried fruit and preserved fruit that keep us going for years afterwards. And we're eating the squash that Patty probably showed you, you know, 22, 23 pound winter squash, and they'll keep for up to a year. So there's never a shortage. There's never a time when we have to worry about what we're going to eat.
Why we have chosen to offer courses on our land is because from a macro perspective, we could work on particular environmental projects and get involved and work on computers and write articles in the newspaper and fight or beg or plead or educate people on environmental issues. But the real truth is that when you put your hands in the earth and you maintain the nucleus that you have and you set example with what it is that you do, that's where you'll see the change happening within people. And having 25 students being here for the last 3 weeks has been more rewarding than any other environmental project that I've ever worked on. So by teaching one person, that person goes off and teaches another. And I think that the feeling that I had when I began, prior to this course beginning, was this sense that I'm about to teach 25 people what it is that I know in permaculture, and I know the experience that I had once I had done my permaculture design course, and realizing what those 25 people are going to bring to themselves and then to their own communities themselves. So the more people that understand it and know about it, then the better off we are on this planet.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. You're listening to Brandon and Patty Bauer of the Blue Raven Permaculture Farm on Salt Spring Island, British Columbia. Permaculture, otherwise known as permanent agriculture or permanent culture, is similar to agriculture in that both systems are consciously designed and maintained. But permacultural systems instead seek to mimic the diversity, stability, and resilience of natural ecosystems. In doing so, permaculture moves beyond the separation of food, energy, shelter, and people, and instead cultivates a harmonious integration of these elements. The philosophy behind permaculture is one of working with, rather than against, nature. When we begin to observe our surroundings through this lens of integrated systems, how we conceive community can change quite dramatically. As Brandon Bauer escorts Deconstructing Dinner's Andrea Langlois around the farm, we can hear Brandon refer to the trees and plants on the farm as part of a community. Community, as permaculture is concerned, involves more than just people.
There's Chinese chestnuts, and English walnuts, and Siberian mulberries, and they're all selected varieties for eating. The mulberries are medicinal as well. There's nitrogen fixers that we put into the communities, the systems, because the nitrogen that the trees and these types of plants fix in the soil feeds and provides nitrogen for the trees around them, and nitrogen is what makes trees grow. So if we provide a plant that's serving that service within the community, then we're putting less energy into the system, and the system is growing on its own very effectively. So there's more chestnuts, there's apples, edible oaks, English black walnuts, or American black walnuts, sorry, cherries, chestnuts, beech. There's more walnuts, there's even some redwoods and sequoias out here, and we've planted some monkey puzzles out. And then I let a lot of the native trees come back too, the apples, the crab apples, and the Saskatoons. We leave them, and then because they are growing there for a reason, and we then graft them over to edible varieties of pears and apples. So using native and natural resources as resource to do the work and make agriculture and fruit selection less expensive.
So how long did it take you from moving onto the land to a place where you felt like you were eating most of the year off the land?
I guess it really started to sink in the third and fourth year. And then now this year we're finally actually getting new fruit, new flowers. I've been, in year five things really start taking off. We're getting our first figs, and all of our Japanese plums fruited this year, so we had five new varieties this year. All four different species of medicinal tree peonies flowered this year, and that's amazing when that happens.
Do you have time and a belly big enough to eat all the food?
God, no. Heck no, I couldn't eat all this. It's great. So I get to give it all away to my friends and sell it at market, and any excess we use to make jams and preserves and save it over the winter. And
you have a box program?
Yeah, we have a box program that supplies six other families in and around both our neighborhood and on island. So that's really effective because it's nice to spread healthy food to people. It feels really good. In this section, most of it is still pretty dark forest. There's lots of alders, but the snow breaks them. We're at such a high elevation that we get a lot of snow and some really cold weather. It gets down to minus 14 up here for periods of time, even as much as 2 to 2 weeks or longer. So many of the things that people can do at sea level, like leave their beets in the ground, we can't do up here. We have to have a mini root cellar and a small storage area that we make in the basement for preserving some of our root crops, some of our more tender root crops. So it's a little bit different, and also we're faced with a particular challenge of a soil type that's very unique. We're on glacial outwash, and it's 20 feet of white sand and small gravel. And it's great drainage, and it's really great. It's a sterile slate without a lot of fungal infection or other things that come with previous agriculture. Mm-hmm. But holding fertility and nutrient in the soil becomes a very large challenge. So probably 50% of our energy goes into building healthy soil so that we can grow healthy food.
People are talking a lot these days about like integrated farming where you have animals. Mm-hmm. What kind of animals do you have here?
Right now we have a dog, as you heard, chickens, and a cat. And I'd like to get some ducks, but we are only on 5 acres, and we've planted so many trees that any of the bigger animals that we would have would really take a lot of energy and maintenance. So we're mostly going to stick with chickens, maybe small fowl, in this system, and they're great. They eat all. They eat a lot of the bugs and pest insects, and then they eat a lot of the weeds and the kitchen scraps and the garden byproducts.
So I have a question that might sound like a devil's advocate question.
Yeah,
I'm going to ask you the question of pretending I'm a skeptic, which I'd have to pretend, but it seems very utopic, very sustainable what you're doing here, but there's a lot of people that live, say, in big cities,
and we
can't all live like this, and a farm like yours probably can't feed more than, I don't know, maybe max 20 people a year. What would be your answer to that problem if we looked at permaculture as, you know, a very optimal type of philosophy?
Well, imagine all the areas in the city where there's trees growing, and many of those trees are flowering ornamental fruit varieties. Many areas are just a lot of grass. And permaculture is really amazing because it can be applied on 5,000 acres and it can be applied on 1/4 of an acre or 500 square feet. Imagine neighborhoods taking the fences down between their backyards and allotment gardening the areas in the back with playfield for children incorporated so that kids still have a safe place to play within a neighborhood block. And there's food growing around all of the houses and on the other side of the street. And the north side of the street with the warm exposure to the sun grows the eggplants and the tomatoes and the peppers and the basil. And the south side of the street grows radishes and peas and spinach and kale and cabbages. And then you swap with your neighbor across the street. And the interesting thing about that is that most people in the city don't know their neighbor across the street. And that's really sad. And so through reduction of isolationism and developing more human interaction that's based around trust as opposed to fear, I think that the cities could probably be some of the most diverse agricultural systems out there. There's diversity from every nation or many nations within a city. Many of those people brought seeds of their parents and grandparents from the country that they lived in. Many of those people, that's some of the richest diversity we have in Canada, comes from settlers over the last 100 years. And lots of cold hardy vegetables and beans and fruits and things like that have come over from Europe and Asia and Africa in the form of people. And they're growing those gardens in their backyards, on their apartment windows, boxes. And if that diversity was cultivated and spread out, an enormous amount of food could be grown in the cities. Not only that, but cities are all built on the original agricultural land of settlers. So the soil within those systems is extremely deep and very fertile.
We're currently walking through the Blue Raven Permaculture Farm here on today's episode of Deconstructing Dinner. The farm is located on Salt Spring Island, British Columbia. With models of permaculture seeking to integrate food, water, shelter, energy, and people into one harmonious and integrated system, the Blue Raven Permaculture Farm incorporates some unique strategies into its daily operations that go beyond just growing food. These strategies are also examined and implemented as part of the farm's 3-week permaculture design course. Certainly one critical piece of any system seeking to integrate humans with our surroundings is dealing with our waste, and in particular, human waste. Deconstructing Dinner's Andrea Langlois spoke with Blue Raven Farm's Patty Bauer on how the human waste on the farm remains on the farm and is used in a rather beneficial way. We're then led into the farm's portable shower to freshen up and receive a lesson on swales and gills. Swales are a human-made land formation used in permaculture to slow and capture rain runoff by spreading it horizontally across the landscape, facilitating the runoff into the soil. Gills, as Patty will also refer to, are groups of plants, animals, and microbacteria which work particularly well together and are one of the primary and ongoing strategies of permaculture systems.
Every time someone uses the outhouse, we obviously mix it with some sawdust or wood chips. And then once that hole's been filled, we cover it up and then let it decompose for about 6 months, and then we plant a tree in it. So that's how we're bringing fertility to the
to the area.
And has people know that if you are actually eating the food with the minerals and nutrients and you're putting it into your septic system, you're basically removing a mass amount of minerals and nutrients from your land. So it's quite crucial to keep that on the land as best you possibly can. Most municipalities, for example, on Salt Spring Island, everybody has a septic system, and that is pumped, and it has been for the past, or up until this year, has been actually shipped off island. So all of our human waste has been shipped off island and been treated elsewhere. So the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that are inherent in doing so is absolutely massive. Fortunately, on Salt Spring, we've begun a composting facility to compost our manure. And we have advocated for a long time for a methane digester to actually be built for the island, because imagine if we could, on a large scale, if all the municipalities actually gathered all their septic refuse, put it in a methane digester, capped it, composted the matter, and then utilized it to run buses or whatever could be run by it. And in order to deal with toxic waste that's found in most of the septic refuse, what you can do is utilize mushrooms to pull out heavy metals from the waste product itself. During the course, we did a series of swales over there, so did a planting with swales, and then established guilds underneath all of our fruit trees. We've done, you'll see that throughout the land, building compost piles or whatever the case. You see them everywhere. I want to show you this sweet idea that we had. What you built? A portable shower. So basically hooked up to the outdoor kitchen and the hand washing station for the students who are living here, we've built a portable shower. So basically four people are able to lift that and move that to another section once the guild in itself is being established throughout the land. And what you see on the contour of this land, where all the scotch broom was, what we end up seeing is a lot of people actually burn their biomass. If they've got tree branches or scotch broom, whatever the case may be, they make a giant bonfire and burn it, and they burn it usually in times when it's raining so that the amount of particulates and greenhouse gas emissions, etc., increases rather significantly. But what we do is we utilize our biomass on contour of the land, and so rather than creating a series of swales, we've created a series of berms on the contour of the land. And what that does is that stops any sort of erosion, and as the water piles up, it slows, it creates fertility in the particular pocket, and you plant trees on the uphill and downhill side of each particular berm. So this area will become a rather exceptionally established planting of all sorts of different fruit and nut trees. There's pine nuts, there's persimmons, there's grafted trees, there's cherries, there's walnuts, there's hawthorns that have been grafted to Asian pears, etc., etc. But one thing which we have gleaned, which has been very beneficial to us, is that when we're building the berms, what ends up happening is that if you ever see a log fall down in the forest, you'll see blackberries, for example, trailing blackberries will come and stitch it down to the earth. Well, what's happening is that all the trailing blackberries are actually stitching down our berms, and then we get a mass amount of flowers, then we get a mass amount of bees, and then we get a mass amount of fruit. So it's absolutely been a really, really fantastic solution to dealing with our biomass.
Permaculture has a set of principles and ethics that we try to abide by and work with. They're more like guidelines, but they give structure to follow. And one of those is use appropriate technology and use technology appropriately. And so the solar shower is incorporating waste products from available technology or byproducts. Many people convert their swimming pools from solar heated water to natural gas heated water. And when they do that, there's a lot of aftermarket solar panels, solar water heaters that come on the secondhand market, and oftentimes they're very inexpensive. And using simple technologies and physics, like the laws of thermodynamics, we can operate that solar shower without a pump mechanism if the system is gravity fed. So it really allows us to warm, to clean ourselves using water in a way that's not consuming non-sustainable energy. It's consuming sun energy. And one thing I've noticed is water is a very conductive element, a fabric almost, and it's very susceptible to electrical energy. So a lot of our water heaters in our houses that heat showers off of electrical energy, the water in the shower feels different than water heated by the sun. And your body responds to that. And so just feeling those things makes you want to cultivate more of those things in your life. So there's a couple of things like that. A lot of the building, almost all the building we do here comes from recycled materials. If we do buy new lumber, then it comes from within a 10-minute walk from our home. If not, it's coming from byproducts of a lot of slab wood use, and people oftentimes move to a new place. They get very busy very quickly, over anxious, so to speak, and they bite off more than they can chew. They cut down a bunch of trees, they mill it up, and then it sits there and it loses value, and then they're looking to get rid of it, and I can come in and take that wood off their hands at a lower value, so to provide a service for them of interacting with their byproduct. And then I bring it home and clean it up, and it's usually cedar, so it lasts a long time anyway. Mm-hmm. And I clean it up and make it nice, and then I use it on the projects here on the farm.
The cry is out. The earth is getting hotter without a doubt. The glaciers are melting in the north and south. Our lives are about to change. There is only one way to survive this. You got to purify your body, get rid of toxins. Pray unto the Father who lives within. The ego you have to tame. Survival is definitely for the fittest. It's not for who get the money or the fame the quickest. Just according to your actions and the way you live it. That is how the Most High I go give it. The sea level is rising, watch the table a turn. Plus the ring of fire around the coastal regions will burn. Check the kind of food you eat and type of drinks you consume. Listen up to the lyrics in the tune. Microorganisms are getting replaced. From the mountain to the sea, it is a different age. It's a time of revelation prophesied by the sage. The surge is the reason why you are made. The heat beneath the ocean, it a bring a hurricane. Attitude inside of people out of context and lame. It's the signs of the times, so what surprising news. Things are occurring in sets of twos. Global warming, the cry is out. Earth is getting hotter without a doubt. The glaciers are melting in the north and south. Our lives are about to change. There is only one way to survive this. You got to purify your body, get rid of toxins. Pray unto Selassie I will live within. The ego you have to tame. The hotter the earth, the more bacteria spread. Many more will have to suffer, plenty more are good dead. In the present and the future, no dramatic events. Purification time is so intense. Trucks will not be able to get supplies to you. It's so obvious, my people, you must grow your own food. Don't depend upon the system, you'll end up getting screwed. This a one, yeah, for sure it is for true. People must experience a radical shift. So they know living in love, it is a heavenly gift. In comedic history, have them things written in it. Out of dirt consciousness, me I dig it. Yo, amazing to the people is the works of the king. Once you disobey in principle, your neck a go ring. Love your neighbor as yourself and love the natural living. So it was in the beginning. Global warming, the cry is out. The earth is getting hotter without a doubt. The glaciers are melting in the north and south. Our lives are about to change. There is only one way to survive this. You got to purify your body, get rid of toxins. Pray unto the Father who lives within. The ego you have to tame. A long time we warn them to stop the pollution. Now them a scramble for solution. Our climate has been through too much alteration. With government misinformation. The greenhouse gases like HFC. And the greenhouse gases like PFC. Are so highly generated in variety. Brought about by this industrial society. So tap into the liquid diet, just try it. Experiment the raw food life, it's so nice.
ingest organic. Don't panic, Jaja want it. The trees produce the energy, foods of all types. Tap into the fine art of fasting, everlasting. Experiment the life of clean air and sunshine. Ingest what's better, do better for your structure. The earth produce the fruits and the grains with enzymes. Global warming, the cry is out. The earth is getting hotter without a doubt. The glaciers are melting in the north and south. Our lives are about to change. There is only one way to survive this. You got to purify your body, get rid of toxins. Pray unto Selassie, I will live within. The ego you have to tame.
Global Warming by Niora, a musician hailing from the island of St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands. This is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. Today's broadcast is archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the July 30th, 2009 episode titled Permaculture at the Blue Raven Farm. Located on Salt Spring Island, British Columbia, Deconstructing Dinner's Andrea Langlois spent a couple of days on the farm in September 2008, shortly before a three-week-long permaculture design course offered at the farm was about to wrap up. Permaculture, otherwise known as permanent agriculture or permanent culture, is similar to agriculture in that both are consciously designed and maintained. But permacultural systems seek to mimic the diversity, stability, and resilience of natural ecosystems. In doing so, permaculture moves beyond the separation of food, energy, shelter, and people, and instead cultivates a harmonious integration of all of these elements. The philosophy behind permaculture is one of working with, rather than against, nature. Closer to the end of today's episode, we'll travel outside of Canada and hear from others around the world exploring the concepts of permaculture, including an urban permaculturalist in San Francisco, California, and some forward-thinking farmers in England. But to close out our visit to the Blue Raven Farm, we'll hear once again from Patty and Brandon Bauer. With the farm being home to a number of studying interns each year, we'll learn of how the interns interact with the farm, and Brandon also shares details on the three-week-long permaculture design course offered at the farm.
And then in order to facilitate the students for the course, we do the meals together three times a day. However, this is an area which is our outdoor kitchen, and this will be utilized for interns who come to study with us on the land. And what we've developed here, it was a project by Catherine, who was an intern from the University of British Columbia, studying with us this summer. And what is all recycled material, which is lovely, which is something that you can find everywhere. And it has a grey water system, and the grease trap that was used. We use all of the oats and barley straw. That after we have harvested the oats and barley straw, we use that because I believe there's a beneficial microorganism that is within the stalks of these. We'll have to ask Catherine about it. She can describe it better. When you talk to Catherine, ask her about the about how the straw acts as attracting the grease from the trap in itself. But it's all fed through here and then down through here, and it's feeding our plantings that are running down to this particular area. So over time, this will get fabulously established, I would say. And this is a small intern garden that's happening through here. This used to be a tree nursery, but we've moved it into a working garden for interns, so that rather than only working with us on the land, they've got their own place to do their own kind of planting and their own testing and things as such. And then all throughout the land, they're working, they're camped all the way through there. And this is where, this is our probably zone 3 going into zone 4 back there. And throughout there are massive amounts of nitrogen fixers, timber, nut trees that are planted all the way throughout. Different projects with different students, we've done mass tree plantings. And usually those are done in the fall or late winter. We have, on a small scale, this is our fifth year, and we've had probably every single season we've had a couple of students. And now that we have more infrastructure in place, we'll be taking 5 students next year to study with us.
Basically, the course consists of 72 hours of class time and 72 hours of hands-on skill training and work in ours or other farmers' gardens. We visited mushroom and sprout facility and farm on island, an organic mushroom and sprout facility, ecoforest operation, where he has many different trees from all over the world planted in his systems. We visited Dan Jason of Salt Spring Seed Company. We visited Michael Abelman of Foxglove Farm, who does extraordinary intensive annual agriculture and high production. And then we spent a considerable amount of time here on the farm. We planted 100 trees on site in 3 weeks. We attached the water catchment system and the overflow system to the house for the rainwater catchment. We looked at solar and AC generated electricity off the grid systems. We talked about, and mostly the curriculum is designed from patterns to details. So we started with ecology and nature and weather and trees and the water cycle and soils. And then we moved into mycology, timber systems, seed agriculture and broad scale agriculture. And then we refined that down even further to individual things like water catchment, electricity, plumbing, propagation, grafting, and now we're doing harvesting and seed saving as well on the farm. And at Dan's we did some of that. So really going from this concept of understanding our teacher, nature, ecology, weather, trees, water, and soil. Those are our teachers, and then our job is constantly to observe and interact with those teachers. And then from there, once we understand the language that they're speaking and what they're trying to show us, then we can go on to design systems that mimic those patterns and relationships. We can act in ways with intention on our own land that mimic those patterns and relationships. So it can be applied on a very small scale with just one tree, three shrubs, and some potatoes, or a very large scale to 500-acre forest plantings and orchard systems and cattle and whatnot. So we're really trying. Oh, and there was a whole section on animals. So how do we incorporate cows and horses and chickens and ducks and pigs and goats and sheep and the occasional elephant maybe into these systems depending on what country we're in?
Snakes I've seen today.
Lots of snakes here. They eat our slugs.
So the maybe biological, I do need some snakes.
Yeah, biological snakes. Diversity again is one of our most important tools here. They really consume a lot of the snakes and slugs and small mice. They eat the grasshoppers, and the snakes are one of our most important resources on site.
We're walking past the garden here. Uh-huh. This one's been put to bed.
One's in the process of being put to bed. There's some things like leeks and cabbage and kale that'll stay in through the winter. And then parsley will make it over winter, but most everything else, we're just finishing harvesting the dry beans. In the white barrels, we have Japanese mountain yams, which are a cold, hardy yam that's true yam to this climate, and it's perennial, so we'll harvest those here in a couple of weeks once the vines die down, collect any seed that's off of it, and see if we can make some more. And they make basically a 1 foot long tuber in those barrels every year. And it's related to Dioscorea, which is a medicinal herb, but it's a perennial food crop that most people have never had. And it's a vine, so it doesn't take up a lot of space, and yet it makes a tuber, so it provides a lot of energy and storage of energy over winter. And it's beautiful. It's got little heart-shaped leaves. And the hummingbirds really love the flowers.
Are they red?
The flowers? No, they're very, very small and white. It's very interesting that they attract hummingbirds. Another thing I'm really amazed at by all of this is the sheer amount of other forms of biological diversity that move into an area when you provide niches and habitat and food. We have so many birds that come and visit us all year long. And because of that, we have all the predators, too. We get the Cooper's hawks and the peregrines and the sharp-shinned hawks. And we have a barred owl, a screech owl, and a northern pygmy owl that I often see hunting on my farm, on this little spot here in the field. And to me, that's a sign that there's a great amount of wealth and health in the system if we can support that level of biological diversity, from the smallest birds like the winter wrens to some of the largest like the eagles, the vultures, and the owls, and the hawks. That's really something that amazes me more than anything. Hmm. And another one is the amount of insects that we have. We documented 9 different species of bees on this land last year, and plus honeybees. So that's 10, if you want to count them. They're not native. All of the other 9 are native wild species to British Columbia. So to me, with all of the other concern that's happening around honeybees and pollination, to cultivate niches and habitat for the native species that do the pollinating is pretty much imperative at this point.
Brandon and Patty Bauer of Blue Raven Farm on Salt Spring Island. Again, you can find more information about the farm and their 3-week-long permaculture design course by visiting the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca. Today's episode is archived under the July 30th, 2009 broadcast. Permaculture is indeed a hot topic across the globe among anyone concerned with sustainability, peak oil, non-renewable energy, water, climate change, and environmental pollution. And the resources available on the internet to learn more about this rapidly growing philosophy of living are quite extensive. Deconstructing Dinner came across a number of interesting segments of permaculturalists from other parts of the world, including this next one of urban permaculturalist Kevin Bayouk of San Francisco.
My name is Kevin Bayouk, and I'm a permaculture designer living here in San Francisco. This is my garden that we're standing in right now. I rent an apartment in an Edwardian home, one block off of Haight Street. Permaculture to me is design science to utilize principles, ecological principles of nature that one can observe, you or I can observe, working in natural systems. We can translate those patterns into designs, and observing how those patterns work, the principles that seem to drive those patterns, applying those principles to the designs to design our lives, to meet all of our needs. So our needs for food, water, shelter, community, loving relationships, comfort, all of those needs. Permaculture provides a way, a pathway to meet all those needs abundantly without taking away from the natural ecosystems. In fact, enhancing them, giving back, providing more conditions conducive to life. Have you ever been on the airplane and they say if the cabin begins to lose pressure, put your mask on first before helping the person next to you? In some ways, that's, to me, the analogous to what we're doing here. In order for me to be effective in helping somebody else, I really need to understand how to take care of my own needs first. And it's at the heart of permaculture, really. The prime directive of permaculture is to be able to take care of your needs first. And then, as soon as you are adequate in that, skilled in that, to begin sharing. The total irony is here, where we're in, bathing in Babylonian affluence. It's like, oh God, I don't even want to know how to take care of my own needs. I can barely pay my rent. I mean, I'm all my costs for my car. I mean, gasoline. Look at gasoline prices. I mean, I have the hour and a half commute. Really, when we step back, though, those are all strategies. Nobody has to go to work. They choose to go to work as a strategy to get the money to pay the rent because they want to have a particular sense of comfort or whatever they want in their life. There's a lot of different strategies to meet those needs. And once we start seeing those strategies, we can begin to design. If I pick that strategy, wow, I can meet both needs at once. If I move to within walking distance where my current job is, all of a sudden I shave off that hour commute every day back and forth. So that's 2 more hours to my day. The redesign of one's life, you can find that there is just an abundance of time and energy if we pick strategies that really are fulfilling us and meeting our needs. Trees are an example of a design decision of how you're going to meet your needs. Santa Rosa plum here definitely yields plums, but it also creates a certain amount of precipitation. There's a lot of fog coming through in San Francisco, a lot of moisture in the air, and the leaves and the branches of the tree are able to precipitate that water and create additional watering for the garden, which is important in a climate where we're almost sub-arid, semi-arid, 20 or so inches a year on average. By looking at forests and seeing how productive they are, the question arises, is there a way we can mimic the pattern of what a forest is providing and design a horticulture, an agriculture that will serve our needs for food, but create all these additional benefits for life? It's very, almost cliche in permaculture now, is the herb spiral. You take a 5.5 feet or 6 foot or diameter circle, and initially when we had first mounted this up, we mounted up some compost and some soil about 4 feet high or so, or a little bit higher. Then we took this urbanite. Urbanite, of course, is broken up concrete. Typically, this ends up in the landfill. Do you know how much landfill or how much garbage goes out of San Francisco every day? 6 million pounds of garbage. So taking this resource that was going to be in the landfill, this couple hundred pounds of concrete, and stacking it in this spiral around that mound, what we created was additional planting space. So that's a design element. We're playing with space, and we're also playing with time in certain ways because there's a successionary principle that we can use, that certain herbs will be growing at certain different times of season. We jokingly call weeds carbon pathways because they're still collecting the photons and capturing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and adding carbon into the soil. A lot of people have the habit and pattern, we're just pulling weeds all the time and they just keep coming back. Well, yeah, they're going to keep coming back because you're creating conditions conducive to the weeds. They're pioneering. They're trying to amend the soil. They're capturing the carbon. They have a lifetime, too. In succession, if we just let them there, over time, they probably wouldn't grow. Once the soil becomes rich enough so that it's not amenable to them, somebody else would come in. Soil is really built in forests and perennial grasslands. Few places in Earth where soil really builds. Building soil, of course, is the absolute contrapositive from all agriculture that we've seen over the last few thousand years. Traditional agriculture is an example of drawing away from natural ecosystems, destroying soil, having a wash away, having all the nutrients, and life. Deserts have a lot less life. Some of the biomass yields, especially from the trees and the perennials, and of course what I don't eat from the annual vegetables, and I harvest that on a regular basis into a pile that I make that's typically 3.5 or 4 feet, by a 4 foot cube essentially. And then I add manure that the ducks provide. I wet it all down with pond water from the bathtub pond. That's the 300 pound cast iron tub with surrounded by 300 or 400 pounds of urbanite. And every morning my meditative ritual is to come out and turn the compost pile. I'm either turning the pile or I'm building the next pile. And it gets really hot. It gets up to say 130, 140, 150 degrees, somewhere in there. I tend to urinate on the pile. For me, it's better than flushing down, 3 to 5 gallons of drinking water down into the combined storm drain sewer system in San Francisco. In about 18 days, I get somewhere around 47,000 cubic inches of great compost soil, which I then return to the garden to create the beds. Well, with the ducks in particular, which are somewhat new to the system, we get an incredible yield. So every morning we get some 3 to 4 eggs or so. And so I get my breakfast typically, that 3-egg omelet with some onion or different greens mixed into a little omelet. So I can have breakfast every morning. And there's enough here that I can have lunch, a salad. There's a diversity of greens. There's some different 60 different edible greens in this garden. I think the disaster is here. If you asked anybody else in the world without the white skin and the Christian name, they would tell you that there is a disaster that's abound. I believe that the crisis is already acute in here. I'm not necessarily feeling it just because of my bioregion and where I am in space and time. Many, 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 many other people are feeling it very acutely every day. I'm going to put all my energy that I feel drawn to it, inspired, just to focus all my intention on the solutions and then to share those with as many people as possible.
San Francisco, California's Kevin Bayouk. A video version of that interview is archived at ryanishungry.com and at archive.org. In taking us to the end of today's one-hour feature on permaculture here on Deconstructing Dinner, we'll travel to England, where an excellent television documentary on permaculture was produced by wildlife filmmaker Rebecca Hosking, who sought to investigate how she might transform her family farm in the county of Devon into a low-energy farm. In her quest for answers, she came across permaculture and a number of English farmers who apply the philosophy on their own land. Here's a short segment from that production featuring some of those permaculturalists featured in the film.
Now I'm realizing we'll probably have to diversify, changing not just how we farm, but what we farm. And this is where I get stuck, because I can see how you can farm cattle without ploughing and using natural fertility. But how do you grow everything else we need? Well, it seems there are a number of people around the world who have already grappled with this problem. They've developed a system known as permaculture. Britain's leading expert is Patrick Whitefield. Permaculture seems to challenge all the normal approaches to farming.
You know, people often think that there are two ways of doing things. One is by drudgery, and the other is by chucking fossil fuel at it. Now, permaculture is about a third way of doing things, and that is by design.
So you're
by
designing...
By conscious design.
Basically, you're designing the labour out, or you're designing the need for that energy out, because...
Both.
Okay. So why does it take so much manpower and energy to sustain farmland when you look at a natural ecosystem and we've got wood behind us?
Yeah.
And that can just keep going.
Because this inherently is not what the landscape wants to do.
Right.
And if you leave the landscape totally alone, it would turn into something like that. So that is sort of the low energy option. In the natural ecosystem, there's no work, well, not by any humans,
yeah.
There's no waste, and yet it's thriving. You know, look at it.
It's easy to forget Britain used to be a forested island. And so much of the energy we expend in farming is just to stop it reverting back. But woodland has evolved over millions of years to be the most efficient growing system in our climate. In that respect, I can understand its appeal if you're trying to design the best way to grow food. But the obvious problem for me is, well, we can't eat trees.
With all the greatest respect, a few wild berries, you can't, it's not a cornfield.
Of course it isn't. Of course it isn't. No, it's insignificant.
Yeah.
So, what we've got to do is to take the principles of this and see how far we can bend them towards something more edible.
A food growing system based on natural ecology really appeals to my naturalist side. But the farmer's daughter in me needs a bit more convincing.
I suppose the big question is could permaculture feed Britain?
Yeah, good question. Although, the first question to ask, actually, is can the present methods go on feeding Britain?
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
And yeah, because actually that is doubtful. Well, no, it's not. In the long term, it's absolutely certain that present methods can't, because they're so entirely dependent on energy. On fossil fuel energy. So we haven't really got any choice other than to find something different.
Last year, I may have dismissed permaculture as not proper farming, but with what I've learnt about the oil situation, I'm keen to see it in practice. A visit to a permaculture smallholding in the mountains of Snowdonia has given me the opportunity. Now, the farmland I'm used to seeing is clumps of trees surrounded by fields. But this is the complete opposite. A collection of small clearings in a massive woodland. It may not look like a farm, but it clearly works. For a few days' work each week, Chris Dixon and his wife Lynn produce all the fruit, veg and meat they need and the fuel to cook it. But 20 years ago, when they arrived, it was degraded, marginal pasture land. The first thing they did was let much of the land return to its natural state. Now the fertility has returned to the land. Observing the forest as it regenerated offered all the inspiration they needed to design their small holding.
But it is a woodland still, and yeah. It is chaos.
It is chaos, but chaos in this space is very, very highly ordered.
Okay.
Very highly structured. It's just that we see it as untidy and a mess. Nature doesn't see it like that at all. Every plant is doing something useful, important, valuable on the site. So, for example, the gorse fixing nitrogen, the bracken collecting potash, that sort of thing. So it gave me the feeling that every plant is important in some way.
Everywhere you go in the Dixon Small Holding seems to be teeming with wildlife.
How important is the biodiversity? So we're hearing birds above us as well. Yeah. How important is all of that to this system?
Very important, because by encouraging the birds, the habitat for birds, mm-hmm. we're encouraging phosphate cycling through the system. So again, phosphates is another of the sort of crucial plant nutrients.
Yeah.
Every plant needs them. And phosphates you'll find in things like insects and seed. So the birds that eat insects and seeds, they're accumulating phosphates, and the excess comes out in their dung.
So up here in the mountains, there's no need for sacks of fossil fuel-derived nutrients. It's all done by nature. Nitrate, potash, phosphate. And no need either for petroleum-based pesticides.
We use ducks, khaki Campbells, as slug control. We've kept ducks for 22 years, and the khaki Campbells are the best slug eaters.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There's a big tip.
And it can be very difficult to find slugs in here during the summer, which is great.
Fantastic,
great,
yeah.
Chris's veg garden may look untidy to a regular gardener, but like in the woodland, every plant is serving a purpose. For example, some deter pests, some help drainage, some encourage bees for pollination, and others have long roots that pull up minerals deep from the soil.
And that was a short segment of Permaculture, Farms for the Future, a television documentary produced by filmmaker and future permaculturalist Rebecca Hosking. Hosking resides in the county of Devon, England. More permaculture resources are available on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca. That was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. Other music heard on today's episode was also courtesy of Adam Shake and Shankar, recorded live in Killaloe, Ontario. Deconstructing Dinner is distributed free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.